So, we are with lawyer Eko Hyphen Benjamin, a very good friend. Welcome to Africanist Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Jesus.
Well, Eko, I am very fascinated by the Hyphen Benjamin family. Every Hyphen Benjamin I've met is really deep. From Yakuba to Kwesi to Harry, your good self. I've not had the honor of meeting your father, your mother. Also particular about the, well, that's an unfair question. First of all, let me start from what I know about your roots. I know you actually Eko Mensa Saba Hyphen Benjamin, am I right?
John Mensa Saba.
John Mensa Saba. John Mensa Saba Hyphen Benjamin. So you are a chip from a deep rock.
Yes.
You are a family of lawyers. Your father was Chief Justice in Botswana,
yes,
from 1981 to 1987.
He was part of his Pan-Africanist rebels.
And from what I hear, from what I just read, he is described as the most activist Chief Justice of Botswana.
He certainly was. It's a strong belief in constitutionalism and a great advocate of bringing our traditional structures to bear.
Exactly.
In defense
defending the sons,
yes, in
Botswana.
In defense of constitutionalism, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But you are a family of lawyers. No. Let me get this straight. So, Kwesi is your cousin.
Kwesi is my brother.
The direct brother?
Direct brother.
Oh, really?
Although there are many Kwesi Hyphen-Benjamins.
Eh? Oh, no. Okay. I'm talking about Kwesi Hyphen-Benjamin in Takoradi.
Ah, Kwesi Hyphen-Benjamin in Takoradi is my cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Yo, Kwesi.
Yeah, yes.
Yes.
And Harry and Yakuba are also your cousins.
Absolutely. I would describe them more as brothers and sisters.
Of course, as Nandan Ketia keeps saying, there is no Akan concept of cousin.
This is not even about the Akan concept. This is just the reality of it. Mm. They are more like brothers than any concept of cousins that you might come across. Just like my father and his, you know, cousins were brothers and sisters. They grew up in the same household for a long period.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your father a bit. You're telling me he was one of the founders of deeply connected to the NLM, the National Liberation Movement. So what, he grew up in Kumasi?
No. My father grew up in Cape Coast and Accra. Grew up in Cape Coast, he grew up in Bakano and in Accra. He was in Jamestown, in the family house.
How is your family connected to Jamestown?
My father's grandmother was from Accra, his mother's mother.
That's very, very interesting. Well, that's a question I posed to a Ga group moderated by Miss Kwe. And I think a proper social history has to be done about that. There are many family connections between Ga's and...
Oh, absolutely. And I think that... I haven't done research on this, so don't quote me as an expert, but I think that those links go back beyond the Gold Coast era.
Mm.
Yes, I think the links between the Cape Coast and Accra Fantis and Ga's go beyond, predate the Gold Coast era.
Mm. I mean, in Bo Daniel's fantastic book, A Tale of Cape Coast, I mean, he kind of jokingly says that the mark of a successful Cape Coast man is to get a beautiful girl wife.
Absolutely. I think that is still the case today.
So it's a wife girl? It's a beautiful wife girl?
She is partly, yes.
Okay.
That's interesting. Just as we are, just as my side of the family is my father's side, is also partly Ga. In fact, he was buried as a Ga man.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know he's passed.
He was,
oh,
yes.
Sorry. I remember I met your mother as well.
Yes.
But I've met her several times. But I remember I was with her at the centenary or something, 150 years, I forget, celebration of the abolition of slavery by the British in the Elmina Castle. And Kufuor gave a speech against reparations. And I had a very deep conversation with your mother. And she actually gave me a book by a former Trinidadian Prime Minister, I think.
Eric Williams, yes.
Eric Williams, exactly. Is that it? So your mother is also deep. Now...
Yes, there's an interesting story. My mother got up straight after university, after having worked a short while, and came to Ghana, newly independent Ghana.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where she taught at Wesley Girls and Accra Girls.
Mm-hmm. What did she teach?
I think she taught Spanish and English.
Mm. Yes. Mm.
You know, yes, yes.
Yeah, excellent.
I've run into a lot of her ex-students from Wesley Girls and Accra Girls. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're a lawyer.
And then she taught at Ghana International in the later years. As well.
Yeah. You are a lawyer. Mm-hmm. You gave a speech on behalf of the profession at Ivo's 50th. Now, to play the devil's advocate, what would you say if I say that lawyers in Ghana, especially today, are quite disappointed in terms of their social responsibility and also in terms of their contribution to the intellect of the society?
Well, you know, there's some truth in that. Although I think the stereotype of lawyers as money grabbing sharks is completely misplaced.
They have to be buried with their face downward.
I think that's a misplaced stereotype. There's a lot of social work that lawyers in Ghana do. I think the very best lawyers here do take their social responsibilities very seriously. However, you know, one could state that the bar has been rather silent about most major issues in later years. They seem to...
That's quite surprising.
You know, they seem to... Politics in Ghana, to a large extent, seems to have been defined nowadays only as a partisan affair. And I think that's wrong. You know, civil society, of which the bar... association forms a part, should always play a major role in the major political and social issues of the day. I don't think that politics should only be defined as partisan politics. I think politics is the method by which we decide how resources are distributed around the society and to what end.
Politics is dirty.
Partisan politics is dirty. Politics need not be dirty at all. I think where you have seen civil society taking the lead, politics has not been dirty at all. Politics has been far more factual and objective when civil society has taken the lead rather than
the politics. In a place like Ghana, the smart thing to do is to have private resolution of public grievance. You don't have good schools, so you send your children to good private schools. Perhaps you don't have roads, you fix your roads. Like a gentleman right here, I hear, I know his gravel.
I think in Ghana, to a large extent, it's every man for himself and the devil for us all. You know, you're right. If you don't have a good road, you get a four-wheel drive if you can afford it.
Exactly.
Which is completely wrong. This should not be the case. I think social infrastructure, social and physical infrastructure is deficient at the moment. But I think
let's talk about the development
of civil society has gone some way to plugging the gap in the social infrastructure.
What does civil society mean to you?
Civil society means to be broadly that broad mass of groups and movements that one would normally call non-governmental organizations, which have plugged the gap in our ability to socially provide amenities. They have stepped in and plugged the gap across the board: healthcare, education, major areas of our national life.
So is Boko Haram civil society?
No, Boko Haram is a
it's non-governmental.
No, Boko Haram is a group of gangsters. I don't think that you can equate.
In other words, what you're saying is not every non-governmental.
Not every non-governmental player is part of civil society, but most non-governmental organizations that are properly registered.
Is Hamas civil society?
Hamas is a government.
Hamas. Hamas, where they are not, well, they are not in government.
Hamas.
They provide a lot of social needs.
I wouldn't. Hamas was always a partisan organization rather than a civil society a movement. I don't think you can be a civil society organization if you have an armed wing. You move beyond the civil society.
Okay, that's very, very interesting. On Monday, the president is going to launch the social protection policy for Ghana. What do you think about policy documents in Ghana?
I think most policy documents in Ghana have never ever been implemented.
Are beyond implementation. What do you think about them as an argument?
I think we're great at putting together beautiful papers and policies on paper that never then see the light of day in terms of their implementation. So we're probably going to hear the umpteenth social policy document from the president, following in a long line of social policy documents in a long line of presidents. But have they been implemented?
I like the point, the distinction you're making between social infrastructure and fiscal infrastructure. This election is also going to be run a lot on fiscal infrastructure.
Yes. But I think we're barking up the wrong tree. I think physical infrastructure is complementary to social infrastructure and not the other way around. I don't think that the emphasis should be put on physical infrastructure, though that is important. The major driver we found in economic growth is not physical infrastructure, it's social capital. That's the total store of cooperation we have in any given society, that is social capital. And you know, that is vastly more important than physical infrastructure. Physical infrastructure is one type of capital, it's physical capital. But it must always bend to the dictates of the society. Social capital is the most important. It overrides everything. Social capital, to my mind, is a major determinant even in the formation of economic capital.
That's very interesting.
Which in turn pays for physical capital and infrastructure. So I think it's important that we shouldn't put the cart before the horse. I think the society that we have to work out, the type of society that we want to have, and then from there we move to building physical manifestations of the society that we have.
Well, one of my favorite social theorists, Michael Mann, argues that the stinty responsibility of the state, the stinty contribution of the political domain, is compulsory social cooperation.
Well, compulsory social cooperation, I don't really believe in a compulsion to do anything, really. That's part of my philosophy is that
we don't
compel people to do anything. People doing things voluntarily is far more powerful than being mandated or forced to do so by some government in Accra or some overbearing entity called the state. Social capital is social capital precisely because it is not mandated by the state. It's the total store of cooperation, voluntary, that we have in a society. That is what dictates you. I don't think you can decree these things. You can't decree cooperation. How do you then back up that decree? You then have...
You then
have to resort to the arms, to the coercive power of the state.
In Michael Mann's framework, when you get to compulsion, you get to another aspect of social power. That's the military domain of social power. And many people say when you get to that domain, you are going beyond politics.
You are.
But the political thing is to essentially trick people.
Wait, let me finish.
To trick people to cooperate without knowing that they are cooperating unwillingly.
Well, I don't think that that's compulsion. You are still getting people to voluntarily do things. But I also think that it's important to be honest, and that the government must be honest. I don't think that...
Honesty is highly exaggerated.
Yeah, but honesty is necessary. It is part of that social capital that I speak of. Governments must tell the truth to their people. It's the only way that governments can retain trust. And governments must be based on the consent of the people. It is essential that you have an honest, competent government that the people elect. And the people must do so freely. And their government that they elect must in turn be honest with them. It is a social contract between the people and their government. Where governments are caught out being routinely dishonest to their people, government lose the trust of the people. Where government loses the trust of the people, it is much harder for government to perform its albeit limited role in my scheme of things. Government would always perform a limited role.
What's your view of government?
My view of government is that government is best suited to do the things that society cannot. Rather than
only when society cannot.
Precisely. I think that society has to find a space in which it can resolve problems.
What if society does not know what is good for it?
Society always knows by the interplay of many actors. Society always comes to know what's best for society.
Most of Ghanaian society have absolutely no idea about the dangers of GMOs.
Well, that is a part where government plays a lead role in educating people, in disseminating information. But civil society also plays a leading role in this, in educating people about the pros and cons of any proposed course of action. I think that governments must do the things that society cannot. If it is the other way around, that societies are doing the things that government cannot, you run the risk of an overbearing government that will soon abolish all your freedoms, along with all your wants.
Let's go back to your point about social capital. Yeah. I mean, the point many people believe in Ghana is that we actually have very high social capital. I mean, in Kwame Nkrumah's unsubmitted PhD thesis, but quite completed PhD thesis, the mind of the primitive mind, and there's no philosophy of that kind. He was actually arguing that in a Kan society, just like Dankwa, we privilege the social over the individual. So we are very social people. We have high social capital. We love our funerals. We love our functions.
No, I think we have a high communal ethos, which is different, I think, to social capital. I think traditionally, you are right, we did have a high degree of social capital, but that social capital has not survived contact with modernity intact. I think modernity has been eating away that social capital, but I don't think that it's a choice of either social capital or modernity.
We now have the miracle of social media,
yes.
Facebook and co, to restore our social capital.
That is where we converse with that kind of society and societal, conditioning in mind. I think much of that has been eroded by our contact with modernity. But I don't think it's a choice.
A social capital is very modern. It's a modern approach to capital formation.
I think the means of forming social capital we have. But I don't think the social capital itself has survived necessarily intact. It's our contact with modernity. It is all about how you modernize. I think one of the major questions of our societies, of every African society, of Africa as a whole, Black Africa as a whole, because I make a distinction. I am not a continentalist. I'm a Pan-Africanist, but I am not a continentalist.
Can you explain that?
I do not believe in the continental approach to Pan-Africanism, that we share the same geographic space and so therefore we must be part of the same organization. I think we've fallen, and the AU has fallen between two stools. Is the concept of Pan-Africanism about a nation, a people sharing common cultural, social...
Let me arrest you there. Are you saying that because of your diasporic Trinidadian roots, And in other words, to say that, if I understand you correctly, I mean, one reason of what you've just said can be that it's not that Pan-Africanism should not be continental, but that Pan-Africanism should be trans-continental.
Finish it off, come on now, put in your glasses.
I don't think, I think the whole Pan-Africanism has suffered from a confusion of identity. Do we form a continental union based merely because we occupy the same geographic space, or should Pan-Africanism be based on common cultural, national, and historic links? Now, if you take the continental approach, then the Caribbean and African Americans are firmly excluded, because then Pan-Africanism is for people who occupy... Let me finish. On the continental approach, then Pan-Africanism is only for people that occupy the African continental space. If, however, you take my approach, that Pan-Africanism is about common cultural, historic links, then Pan-Africanism probably excludes North Africa, but includes the Caribbean and African Americans and Latin Americans of African descent.
Aborigines in Australia?
No.
Why not?
But their descent from Africa is not commonly...
They're black.
They are black, but not all, you know. It doesn't just mean a black skin. When I say cultural and historic links, there are many people who qualify under that definition of Pan-Africanism who aren't dark skin.
So let me get it straight. Are Egyptians part of your Pan-Africanist ideal?
The original Egyptians, who are not the current Egyptians, are Arabs from the Arabian Peninsula. The ancient Egyptians, as Sheikh Anta Diop and John Henry Clark, the Diane of Pan-Africanist historians, may he rest in peace, would argue that the original Egyptians actually occupy this part of the world and the rest of Africa now. And so they would qualify. But current Egyptians, I don't know how strong they consider. They do have original African descent in them, the Egyptians. The original population didn't necessarily entirely go away, but to a large extent, I think they were absorbed into the Arab population. It all depends whether they view their future as part of the African nation, or whether they view their future as part of the Arab nation.
Well, that's definitely, the truth.
I don't think you can be both. I really don't.
They want to both, obviously.
You cannot be both. Their description of being Pan-Africanist because they are in Africa is not good enough. It must be that they consider themselves part of the Pan-African project because they are of Africa, not in Africa.
That's very deep.
Yes.
Typical hate from Benjamin. Now, you've lost me. I mean, Kwame Anthony Appiah, the Ghanaian philosopher, says that Pan-Africanism, African Union, blah, 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 the risk of oversimplifying him is essentially nonsense. Africa is essentially a geographical concept.
I understand where he's coming from, and where you have the concept of continental Pan-Africanism, then he would be absolutely correct. If, however, you're having a Pan-Africanism, and I do admit Pan-Africanism is a fairly new concept and philosophy in history, in historical terms, from the early 20th century. The early 20th century, with its genesis in the diaspora.
Let me declare an interest. Here, apart from coming for Ivor's bed.
But I think he's wrong when he says when he suggests that Pan-Africanism as a concept is something probably unachievable or nonsense, as you might put it more politely. I understand where he's coming from, in that Africans, much like Europeans, have long had distinct identities through their different societies. They've long had distinct, ancient and distinct roots and heritages. I get that. I understand that. However, you will find that despite our multiplicity of languages, ask the sociologists and the linguists, despite our multiplicity of languages, Africa has the longest stretch of linguistic linguistic into understanding of linguistic coherence, the longest stretch in the world between different languages. Most African languages from Senegal to South Africa are closer in their makeup than, let's say, Spanish and Italian.
I don't think, yes. That's a very specific.
For instance, we are told that Southern Africa has a multiplicity of languages, but in fact, most of them are Soto languages and are mutually intelligible to each other. They have a common root. So Africa has many languages, but Africa doesn't, if you see what I mean.
I don't really have the technical expertise to change.
I would refer you to Dr. KK Pra has done great work.
KK Pra, I know him very well. Yes. KC Pra.
Yes.
Many people, yes. Okay, I'll check his stuff. I mean, he was one of our mentors at African Security Dialogue and Research. Yes. And yes, I must check his work a bit more.
He's done great work.
But on the other hand, I remember one good.
And Molefe Kete Senti.
All these guys, many people will say Molefe is the founder of Afrocentricity. Many people will say that both Dr. Pra and Professor Santi are sentimentalist Africans.
They are not sentimentalist Africans. I think they back their work with solid research, provable, evidence.
Let me tell you. I mean, when Google was trying to establish Ghanaian languages as a part of their search engine.
Mm-hmm.
I remember taking a Google official, Devon Lam, to one of the authorities, one of the founders, academic linguistic studies in Ghana, Professor Lawrence Woody. An impression I got from him is purified. Our languages are quite complicated. I mean, Akan Cree is very dominant. But the other languages are essentially very different languages. I mean, Guan, for instance, is supposed to be very different.
Well, that's his opinion. I mean, the sociologists and linguists would beg to differ.
He's a linguist. He's the founder of linguistics in Ghana.
Yes, but look, and I'm no expert, but I would refer you to the other experts who would argue.
Malefica Sanz is our linguist. Malefica Sanz is our linguist.
But they do base their research on linguists. And there are linguists who would argue that there is a great deal of mutual intelligibility to the languages, not just in Ghana, but across sub-Saharan Africa. Let me just get some ice. Yeah, but across the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. I don't think that the idea that there's that we have great diversity defeats the idea that we are essentially one people.
Okay.
Black Africa.
So let's take you to one of the primary Pan-Africans, Kwame Nkrumah.
I mean, America itself is 50 different countries, really, if you come down to it.
They are powerful. They have enough social power. McDonald's
yeah,
unites America.
That kind of power was built after they settled their own national question in the 19th century, the Civil War. Had the Civil War not gone the way it did, the continental America may well be 4 or 5 different countries.
Are you implying?
What I'm saying is that differences of language and outlook need not necessarily defeat their drive to form one nation south of the Sahara. America did it over a whole continent. We may argue about the methods. About the methods that America took to do it. I think those methods are probably unacceptable in today's world.
I think you could
take Germany as an example as how Germany unified. Germany didn't unify necessarily only by armed force and wiping out the other people occupying the space. I think Germany very much unified on the basis, first, of demonstrable political success of its leading parts, first, then unified around a common idea of the Germanic people. And it was hard working. Germany was many different countries as late as 1860. Germany, as late as 1850, Germany was many different countries. Germany is a very new country. I don't know. Italy is another country that's very late in the day, that was formed very late in the day. I don't think that, you know, linguistic nuance should be about long term to the African unity that we talk about. So long as that African unity is predicated upon common culture and historic links.
How can you generate a common African culture?
I didn't say common African culture. I don't think there's a common American culture. I don't think there's a common German culture. I think there's a standard German culture, German language, and then there are many German cultures. And then there are many, many German cultures, for instance, many German cultures and dialects. But there's one standard German language.
Yeah, let's come back.
And one conception of a national German culture. But that is layered on top of the diversity they have. It doesn't replace it.
Let's calm down theoretical logic. I don't even know why I allowed myself to get into such a high...
Because it's an important and interesting topic. I think it's vital.
Let's talk about the Ghanaian middle class.
Yes. It's not a middle class. We don't have a middle class.
Can you explain that further?
We don't have that broad mass of people linked by common manners and outlook of life, common values, that one would normally ascribe to a middle class. I don't think a middle class is just about income level. And even if one based your middle class simply on an income measure, we still don't have a middle class. We don't have the level of income that forms a middle class. We don't have enough people.
Why if I say that theoretically? Just a minute. What do I say that for purposes of argument, anybody who is able to spend 40 cedis a day in Ghana today is middle class? Remember, middle class, not upper class.
No. I don't think that, you know, as a political, economic, and social concept, that's no measure at all. First of all, even if one was only looking at the middle class upon the upon an income-based approach, you know, I still don't think...
Money is important. Money is a universal infrastructure.
No, I think the middle class in terms of income would have a common measure worldwide. Middle class, if you're talking solely, and I hasten to add, if you're talking solely about measuring a middle class of income, you are going to, you know, a middle class person would normally be the person who can afford his own home, or at least to be able to rent.
Many Ghanaians can afford their own home. We are sitting in $1 million home.
Many, but those are the rich, and they form.
There are many rich Ghanaians.
There are many rich Ghanaians, and that is why our society is as unstable as it is. You have a big chunk of rich people. There's a very thin middle class or no middle class, and then a broad mass of the dispossessed.
Okay. Let's talk about upper class.
I think that what Nana Addo had said some time ago about a society not being able, about a society that's not able to cater to the needs of a broad mass of people, is a society that can't protect the rich. And I think that's so correct. You know,
That's self-serving.
It is not self-serving. I think it's absolutely correct. I think where you have this situation where you have quite a few rich people, a very thin middle class,
Essentially, social intervention, the protection for the poor, is insurance for the rich.
Hold on, I'm coming there. Social capital is your best guarantee of the formation of your middle class. And a middle class, it's a circular argument. And a middle class, a large middle class, is your best guarantor of increasing social capital. You know, a middle class, I mean, let's go back. If you were just talking about a middle class at income-based level, we don't have one. If you're talking about a middle class proper, of a group of the broad mass of society sharing common values, common manners, common outlook on life, we don't have a middle class. Now, if you look at what a middle class looks like, rather than measuring it by income or by common values, if you look at what a middle class looks like, your teachers, your nurses, your firemen, all right, your firemen, your police officers, they would normally be part of a middle class. But right now in Ghana, I don't think they form one. There's no
coherence. In Ghana, well, I agree with you. There's a lot of inequality in Ghana right now.
A middle class would normally be the broad mass of society.
No, not necessarily.
I don't think it would be broad. And you'd have lower middle class, upper middle class, and most
like in Britain.
Are wealthy people. But you know, but the middle class extends beyond those prosperous big lawyers, big accountants, etc., etc. You should include your teachers, your nurses, your junior doctors.
Let's suspend your army officers.
These should only be part of the middle class.
Let's suspend
the common outlook.
Let's suspend. Defining upper, middle, lower, right. Blah blah. Let's talk about lawyers for instance.
Yes.
I mean, apart from a few lawyers like Issam Kuma and Co.
Yes.
You are cool. I know you very well. I mean, you're very intelligent. But socially, if I might put it on the spot, I'm sure you shy away from intervening in our national processes.
No. Even though I've said earlier that the partisanship is too dominant. I still don't believe that Ghana is that unforgiving a society, a place where one would have to shy away from, you know, interventions in social life for fear of punishment. I still think that we still have a society as a whole. Let me give you some examples, both historically and currently, okay, about our Ghanaian society, and I think. The closeness of it. As I told you earlier, my father was one of the founding members of the NLM in the Central Region, and yet some of his best friends were called Swansea and CPP luminaries at that time. In fact, he was appointed by Nkrumah himself to come up as a creative job in the Attorney General's Department, to come through to the Attorney General's Department and then through to the bench. I think from 1962 onwards, I think Nkrumah was a little less tolerant of diversity, but it existed before then and it's existed since. Look, I don't think that partisan politics should be the basis of your outlook on life. It is too unstable, too ephemeral, you know, too untrustworthy to base your approach to life and friendships on partisan politics.
That reminds me of a point that F.L. Battelle made to Lawyer Mercer. Lawyer Mercer, who served as Nkrumah's High Commissioner to the United Kingdom. And paraphrasing Battelle, after Mercer had his problems with Nkrumah, he says, well, I told you, these guys will eat you up. But the point is, political parties are the dominant mode for involvement in national affairs.
Absolutely.
Whether you like it or not.
And so should it remain. I'm not.
It should remain so. If you want to be influential, but if you want to affect the goal attainment of the society, stick your neck out.
I said partisanship. Now,
There's nothing wrong with partisanship,
but I don't think it should dominate the entire political landscape. I do think there's such a thing as multi-partisanship and bipartisanship, and then when civil society enters, you have no partisanship. You then have more objectivity.
I'm here as a consultant to the Institute of Democratic Governance.
But I would say this, as I said, as the earlier example, and you have current examples. I don't think that, you know, it would be a very sad day if, because somebody stuck his neck out in a social intervention in Ghana, then people went after him and took his home. I think it would be a very, very sad day.
The
concept of partisanship, I think that kind of behavior,
the truth of the matter is that is most unlikely in today's Ghana.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm saying it's most unlikely that if you stick your neck out, you'll be cut out because you're partisan.
I'm saying that in Ghana today, and there'd be much less social blowback or material consequence to making your opinion heard, and that's a very good thing. I understand. I understand that the current president, Mahama, has many friends who are not in the NEC or you know, who are not. He has wide-ranging friendships. And I think the same is true of Nana Addo. I think the same is true of my brother Ivo. You know, I think that's the way it should be.
Let me tell you a story about Mahama. I think Mahama was just a year ahead of me, or maybe two years ahead of me in Lagos. He was a secretary of the SRC.
Yes.
And I had this friend who unfortunately was killed by Ajib Widi at the...
Right, the warrant officer, yes.
The warrant officer, my good friend, Kwame Ajiman.
Right, yes.
I was in my friend's room, C18 in Legon Hall.
Yes.
And I was having a conversation with Kwame Ajiman. Kwame Ajiman was sort of a university student, by the sense that he lived on Legon campus.
Yes.
And he's the sort of guy, he would go and rap water girls. Like, you know the way he used to rap them? He would take their dirty teddy bears to clean them.
Absolutely.
Dry clean them.
Ladies always like the helpful people.
But Kwame Ajiman was also an old-fashioned communist.
Right, okay.
So, in point of fact, I'm with John Mahama in Patapé's room.
Yes.
And Kwame Ajiman is cleaning a Volta lady's teddy bear. And Kwame Ajiman tells me he was connected with Bwachijan.
Right, yes.
Bwachijan had a movement with Kuke Kubakwenko called the Movement for National Affairs, National Monarchs.
Mm.
Their plan was that the Rawlings School should have happened in 1981. The plan of Monas, where people like Captain Smith, Bannerman and Co., was to stage a coup in 1984 on the centenary of the Berlin conference. And I'm very, very happy that Bwachijan didn't succeed.
Right.
Anyway, to go back to the story. So Kwame Ajiman tells me, cleaning his teddy bear, with John Mahama sitting on Karpathapé's bed, it was, you know, your father is on the list of people who shall eliminate.
Mahama.
No. Kwame Ajiman.
Right, telling Mahama.
No, Kwame Ajiman telling me.
Oh, right, okay.
So my father was a big businessman.
Yes.
That your father is one of the people who will eliminate when we come to power.
My word.
And actually, now that I think about it, I think it's because it's quite possible John Mahama's own father was on the list.
Was on the list as well, yes.
But I remember me and John Mahama blasting Kwame Ajiman on this point.
Right.
I've forgotten the trend of my thought now. But essentially, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that, in a sense, when we were Legon, I don't know the situation now. I mean, I saw some guys from Commonwealth Hall recently, and they were in bloody jackets and ties.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not my view of vandals. I retired from university teaching over 10 years ago, and I have absolutely no idea of the mentalities of the university students now. But from the outside, I think that there's a certain embourgeoisment, generally, from the youth in this country.
Yes.
But the point I'm making is that...
A certain dumbing down.
It should be possible to be radical without being, for lack of a better word, blood testing.
Absolutely. Some of the most radical reforms passed in the world have been passed without a single drop of blood being spilled. And some of the more useful ones, in fact, the most useful radical reforms have been pushed through without any blood being spilled. Through the political process.
Well, look, this has been a long chat. Thank you very much. Typical Hickman Benjamin.
I think it's possible to be radical without being bloodthirsty. I think once you cross the line between being radical and bloodthirsty, you become a traitor.
Well, to be very, very honest.
That's treason. Once you cross the line between radical thought and the spilling of blood in the attempt to remove a constitutionally established government, you cross the line between radicalism into treason. I think
as I said,
yes.
Kwame Ajiman, for instance, was eventually eaten up
by
the revolution.
Yeah, a revolution always eats its own children. That's why I'm always in favor of evolution and not revolution.
Thank you very much. Echo Ephraim Benjamin. Lawyer, mention the name of your firm. Let's give you some publicity on Africanist Radio. What's the name of your firm?
Hey, from Benjamin, Addo and Barry.
Excellent, excellent. And my regards to Barry.
Yes, absolutely.
A funky birthday at Kekobite.
Absolutely.